Hello, young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because...
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and you're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark. And each night we'll bring you the best and the brightest authors and experts with something called solutions, the topics you want to hear, and the people who know to bring them to you. So let's do it together. Let's get to the heart of the issues that face us every day, right here, right now on Dresser After Dark, coast to coast and around the world on the BBS Radio Network.
Young lovers, whatever you do, say don't cry because I'm alone. All of my memories are happy tonight. I have had a love of my own. Hallelujah!
Sharon Wolf with us, New York State licensed psychotherapist. She's been a frequent media commentator on celebrity marriage and divorce, has written 5 self-help books. Her latest is Do As I Say, Not As I Do. Renowned relationship counselor's memoirs reveal a dark secret, a failing marriage. Sharon, hi, welcome to the show.
Hi, Michael. How are you?
Oh, I am good, and thank you so much for being here. You know, there are so many people who would not admit, not even write a book about it, but not even admit to it. You've dealt with people for so many years. You've helped people through relationship problems. You've kept people together, and you've done all the things that a counselor could do. But all of a sudden, one day, you turn around, you look in the mirror, and you go, whoops, how about my own advice?
That's exactly what I said to myself. Actually, the name of the book is Love Shrinks.
Oh, I got it wrong. Okay, wait a minute. Let me do it again. The author of Love Shrinks, a memoir of a marriage counselor's divorce. How's that?
That's perfect, Michael. Thank you so much. And that's exactly what happened. I looked in the mirror and said, I'm giving all this advice to people about how to stay lovers for life, and I'm going home to a failed marriage. I didn't want it to be true, but it was true.
Now, but when you say failed marriage, what failed? What was it in the marriage that wasn't bonding the two of you?
Well, actually, I should take that back and say, for it was a good marriage for a certain time of my life. It wasn't the marriage for me to be in for my whole life. And that's what I had to work out for myself, as we all do.
Okay, so in essence, and not today, because I wish I could say this today, but more than 30, 40, 50 years ago, when somebody got married, that was, you know, you love, honor and obey for the rest of your life. 55-60% of marriages end up in divorce in the first year. So that's not necessarily the thing we can say anymore. What is it that you do when you get married that, you know, you take vows and maybe you mean them at the time, but not you now, but 6 months later, it's down the tubes?
Well, marriages go through 3 stages. They go through the discovery stage where you think, oh my gosh, this person is perfect for me. Nothing can go wrong. Then they go through a disappointment stage where you start to say, if only he, if only she. And then they go to a devaluation stage where you say, this is not the person I thought he was. And from that stage, it either goes to learning the tools to keep your love alive, or it leads to divorce.
Now, is that because, and most of this when we say, you know, they're not who I thought they were going to be or who they are, is that because we're not honest in front? You know, you and I meet, I'm not going to let you know who I am. I'm going to give you, because I like you, so I'm going to show you who I think you want me to be. And the problem there is, once we get together and everything is fine, the real me starts to come out. And there, I think, is where the problem lies.
Well, I think that that's true for a lot of people. It's not something we do on purpose, but we all want to be loved. We all are seeking love. And, you know, I talk about that in Love Shrinks. I married a musician, and I did want to be the person that he loved. I did want to be the person who was right for him. But I didn't think I was being untrue to myself in trying to be that person for him.
Yeah, but you were there with him for a lot of years, true?
I was with him for 15 years. We were together a long, long time, absolutely. And not all 15 years were bad. The beginning was really good, but then things changed, and that's what happens. He went one way, I went another way, and we were not able to bridge that gap.
Okay, now everything. Now, obviously, when we learn things, life lessons are much better than academic lessons. You know, the true learning is when you get out of school and you get out in the street and you realize there's a little more to it than came out of a book. So, really, the question is, let's say now everything that you've learned now, let's say you're not a psychotherapist, I'm not a talk show host. We meet. We like each other. What do we do to make it last? What do we do to get that bond going so we're not going to 3, 5, 10 years later say, well, it's not what I thought it was. Goodbye.
Well, we certainly try to learn from our past mistakes. We learn how to fight fair. We learn how to communicate our feelings gently to each other. We learn how to ask, instead of me asking why you're impossible to live with, I need to be asking why I'm impossible to live with.
By the way, I think that in and of itself is a very powerful statement. From what I have seen through my life, Sharon, that most people, they may walk up to you and tell you that they don't like you, they don't like this, they don't like that, or you'll get the look, and it has nothing to do with you. They're projecting. And I think right there you've got to be spot on with it, because it's what is it about me that's causing this to happen, because where am I projecting? That person, for the most part, I really feel after years of studying people and walking through life and sometimes running through life, that it is nothing more than who we see ourselves, and we don't like it, and we put it on them, and the problems start.
Well, I think that's absolutely true. We project onto other people, and we also project how they think about us. We have ideas about what they feel about us. So, for example, part of the divorce rate is you think a person has a feeling about you that they never had. They still marry you, but they don't love you in the way you need to be loved. And also, you may not know how to have an enduring love relationship yourself.
Yeah, but how do I know how you love? And I think that's a very important question. We meet, how do I know how you receive love? I'm a guy. I'm going to take it for granted that I know.
I need to be able to communicate that to you. I need to be able to tell you when I feel loved and when I don't.
Or what steps to take to say this is how I've learned that love is. Maybe, hypothetically, maybe love is buying you a present. Maybe that's the way you receive love. If I don't know that, and I give you every other way that I've learned to receive love, and it's not the way you've learned to receive it, and I never buy you anything, there's where the problem starts, because now I don't love you, and at the same time, I'm giving you everything I could possibly give you.
And that's exactly what happens. A man might think that he can fix things, or you might think that you can fix things for me. You can fix my hair dryer, make sure my car is running right. You're taking care of me. You're loving me. When really what I want is that gift. It can just be a trinket, but that's what I need to feel loved. I need to be able to communicate to you, honey, what you do for me is wonderful, but what I really need to feel loved is if you just stop at the 5 and dime and pick up a card and write I love you on it. That's what I really want to hear from you.
And what it comes down to, you just said it. What do you mean I don't love you? I put a new battery in your car.
And I would say to you, that is so wonderful, and it's one of the things I love most about you. But I'm kind of different from you, and the kind of thing that makes me feel loved is when you write it down. When I see your handwriting with those words, that makes me feel very sexy.
By the way, that scenario in and of itself could probably save a good 70% of the 50-some-odd percent of marriages that don't work in the first year.
I think it might.
Yeah. I mean, and by the way, it happens to be simple. The problem, Sharon, is we don't know. You've gone through a certain period of your life. You have studied. You work with people. You have hands-on experience. The average person doesn't. And that's where I think the problem is. Who has taught anybody in school how to stay in love, how to be in love, how to be able to get longevity out of a relationship? I can't remember a class that was ever offered. Or something. Do we still have you? Did I lose you? well, we might have lost her. That's the last time that I get that. But it's the last time they get that friendly. Okay, when you really come down, when you really come down to it, that's really what it's about. You know, if you're listening out there right now, if you're married, you're with somebody, you're in a relationship, ask them how they receive love. It's a very simple question. And I really believe that the complexity of what people think relationships are not complex. It's as simple as a very simple, how do you receive it? And then what can
Michael,
I do?
Was it something yes. I said?
Well, that's what I said. I said, there goes the relationship.
It was over before it even began. We never even got to walk down the aisle.
Darn it. You know, as I said, we lost each other. I went, whoops, maybe we shouldn't have gone there.
It happened when you said that would save a lot of marriages, and it was over.
You know what I really
Ours
think?
Ours was
this,
over.
It's we weren't wearing the tinfoil, and the White House was after us. No good.
That's what I love about you, darling. You're so funny.
Thank you. But you know, when you really come down to what I really believe in is that moment or so that when we weren't together here, it's that everybody thinks that relationships are so complex. They're not. It's just that simple, as we were talking about. How do you receive love? What's going to make you happy? How do you enjoy yourself? We don't ask the questions.
Well, I think you're right. We don't communicate what we need. We imagine that he'll know. If he really loved me, he would know. And, you know, I talk about that in Love Shrinks, too. The idea that if he really loved me, he would know what I needed. And I don't have to say anything. But, of course, that's not true. He doesn't have a crystal ball.
No, absolutely. And I think there's something else to take into consideration also. The divorce is prevalent today. I don't want to, you know, beat this drum too far, but older people are now getting divorced, and the culture has changed so drastically, Sharon, that there are people who are, you know, 50, 60 years old. Where do I start? What do I do? How do I talk to someone? It is not the same world out there.
I was just talking to somebody today who lost his wife 2 years ago. He's 78 years old, and he's dating.
Hmm.
For the first time in 50 years. And all of the confidence that he built as a husband for all those years, he knew exactly what his wife wanted. She knew everything he was going to say before he said it. Suddenly he lost all his confidence because he's trying at a much older age to snag a beauty.
But think about this. If they weren't 20 years younger than he is, let's say, and they go out today. You know, when I was a kid, it was, hi, what's your sign? Do you come here often? And that worked. That doesn't work today. So there's got to be a completely different way of communicating. And I think that it gets lost in transition. And to get it back again, they're going to have to go out there and take some knocks or, quote unquote, go to a class that will teach you how to do it.
Stop texting and go to a class where you can learn how to be romantic 101.
Yes. I think they're great. When are you going to start the webinars?
That sounds perfect. That's exactly what I'd like to be doing.
Yeah, but think about that. I mean, what a natural draw. I see tons of stuff coming through with the, you know, on the website and so on and so forth. I never see anybody having a class on how to be in love, how to be in a relationship, how to what not to say on the first date.
How to say hello. Forget
yes.
the first date, how you even say hello to someone and get started, what flirting is, how to flirt.
Yeah, by the way, there's your next book.
There you go.
Yeah, I couldn't spell flirt 10 years ago, and now I are one.
Well, it's, you know, people think, when they think of flirtation, they think of sex, and those two things don't always go together. Flirting is a powerful way to let somebody know, let somebody feel great about themselves. It's a way to make people feel great. It doesn't always have to involve sex, so people don't need to be so afraid of it.
No, by the way, I think sex is an absolutely wonderful thing. Wonderful, all right. But at the same time, when you're done, you have to have something to talk about. You cannot spend 24 hours a day in bed.
I have a lot of people that would tell you they'd like to, but you're right, it's impossible. We have jobs, we have mortgages, we need dental work, we have leaky toilets, we have children from previous marriages, we have all kinds of things that get in the way of that. and that require us to be mature adults coming together, getting to know each other, and taking the high road.
Yeah. No, and that's absolutely what it is. And I really truly believe that, you know, when people talk about they want somebody a lot younger than they are, what are you going to talk about when it's all over and done? You've got to be able to have somebody that you can communicate with and understands life in the same way that you understand life, coming from maybe a particular culture, you know, of looking at things a certain way.
Like the same music. You know the same music. You know the same TV shows. You remember the same movies. There's a deeper context of connection.
Yes, and all due respect to 20-year-olds and 25-year-olds, I would have nothing to say to one.
I think I would have nothing to say to one either. I think, well, first of all, they'd be my children, so
that's there. Well, how about this? You could say, cute iPhone.
Yeah.
then you're done.
No, cute iPhone. Text me again, darling.
Yeah. I mean, that's exactly what you're talking about. There was a world years ago that there was something called humanity involved. People touched each other. People talked to each other. I'm not saying it was any better or any worse, but there's too many people going high tech today. They've lost that
people
sense.
People wrote each other letters. They took the time slowly to even, people don't even call each other on the phone anymore. They took the time to talk to each other slowly and get to know each other. They courted.
Yeah. And if you lose that sense of humanity, there goes the communication that if you're older and divorced or separated in the world today to go out and to get, quote unquote, relinked up again, because the language is different, the bonding is different, and I really believe men and women are different today.
Well, men and women are different. They've always been different, but they're even more different today.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I completely agree to that. Sharon, we're running out of time. I'm getting
things.
Okay. Now, is there a website we can find you at and get the book?
Yes, it's www.SharonWolf, SHARYN, and Wolf, just like the animal, .com. And, of course, you can get it on Amazon, or today is its pub date, so you can get it in any bookstore. But it's definitely there on Amazon.com.
Wonderful. Sharon Wolf, I'll leave you with one comment. You know, you said at 21 or so they would be your kids. At 41 or so, they'd be mine.
Okay. And let me just remind you, it's love shrinks, not do as I say as I do. It's love shrinks.
I got it. Love shrinks.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Good night.
All right. Bye-bye now.
That's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you. And a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. That's all. That's all. Say it's me that you adore. Yeah, it's me that you adore. For now and evermore. That's all.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and you are listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Dr. Kirk Sinclair with us, respected teacher, speaker, and a musician. He's the author of the academically acclaimed System Out of Balance and the upcoming The Five Forgotten Truths, A Natural Guide for Believing in Humanity. And he draws from his expertise in ecology and cultural anthropology for his focus on humanitarian issues. He is the leading expert on the modern nomadic culture of long-distance backpacking expeditions, and he's got over 15,000 miles of experience. Kirk, I welcome to the show.
Wow, thanks, Michael. Quite an introduction there. I appreciate it.
And thank you so much for being here. You know, when it really comes down to it, people have forgot. Just actually, the interview right before this one, people forget what humanity is all about. And it's going out there like you do, the 15,000 miles of experience. You've walked the land with a backpack. You've met people. You've met people from all different walks of life. If there was one overarching theme, Kirk, that you learned out of that, what would it be?
Well, naturally, we were intended to belong to others, as opposed to what has happened in our civilized world, so to speak, where we start belonging to material things or ideologies or lots of other things that get us away from belonging to the small community that, you know, that's how we evolved. That's how we started things out, living together in small bands and with the intimacy that was involved in that. We belonged to others instead of things or ideas or what have you. And that's something I learned while long-distance backpacking, because I was always backpacking with a small band, if you will, and sort of reenacting what earlier nomadic life was
sure.
like.
Now, by the way, I learned a long time ago that people will say things and you don't have to take them personally and you can just walk away. You don't have to stand up for what, you know, what you think is the way it is. I remember probably 20 years ago, my ex-wife was a runner. You know, she probably still does it today. She runs in relays. And we went up to the university. And I got there first. We were supposed to meet up there. She was going to get her number. And I got up there first, and one of the kids, there was about three or four young women sitting behind the desk giving out the numbers. And one of the kids looked at me and she said, "Can I help you?" I said, "No, I'm waiting for my wife." And she looked at me and the other two got incensed. And she said, "What do you mean, your wife? She doesn't belong to you." And I thought, "Yeah, well, yeah, she does. Yeah, it's mine." But the point of contention is some of that has caused a rift. It's caused a separation in us.
Well, yeah, I think a lot of this misunderstanding, if you will, I think there's sort of two roots to it. One is we tend to, on the one hand, we tend to live down to expectations, all right? And we have plenty of lowered expectations, whether we're hearing about how greed is good or, you know, that we're governed by the invisible hand of self-interest or what have you. So that's one thing that's going on. And the other thing that's going on is, you know, we're in a very much an anonymous culture now, you know, a large, centralized, anonymous kind of culture, and we lose touch with each other, and in fact, I heard you talking about that with the previous guest, and, you know, it struck a chord. We're losing touch with each other, in a sense, and, you know, when that happens, people get their ruffled their feathers when it shouldn't be ruffled, and
sure.
All sorts of things start happening that wouldn't happen if we were more intimately connected with each other.
Yeah, you know, I have an answer for someone that would say, I'll use the word dum-dum instead of the other one. You know, walking up, they'll say, you know, you're a real dum-dum. And in my response to it and is usually the same thing. I'll smile and I say, yeah, I'm really good at it too. It's over. It doesn't have the effect. I'm on my way. I'm doing whatever I'm doing. It's called diffuse. Don't debate. You're not going to win.
Right.
Now.
Yeah, that's a good philosophy there.
Oh, no, absolutely. You know, and it lets them go about their business. I go about my business, and I'm happy with it. Now, local humanitarian efforts. There are so many different places, and Kirk, they think differently. They live differently. And you've seen them. How do you balance it out? How do you get involved in a local humanitarian effort? At base, are we dealing with the same thing no matter where you go?
Well, first of all, if I may, I'd like to make a distinction between, say, the kind of humanitarian effort that we're really lacking at these days, which is civic involvement, and that has decreased from, like, it was low. It's always been low in recent times. It was like at 12% in 1989, 12% of the population involved in some kind of civic involvement, and now it's like at 6%. And I'd like to make a distinction of that in contrast with what people may be hearing good news about, and that is there's certain kinds of involvement that's going way up, you know, people working at soup kitchens and things like that. And the importance of that distinction is, okay, we're finding an avenue to feel good about ourselves, if you will, but we're not rolling up our sleeves and working together with each other. That's really the essence of that distinction there. And my platform, I guess, is trying to address what's going down, not what's going up, the type of civic involvement where people aren't rolling up their sleeves as much to work together with each other. And for examples of that, there's a few organizations where people roll up their sleeves. I guess I'll use that as a buzzword. Sure. Lions Clubs, for instance. Lions Clubs is something where I'm a Lion, and in particular, as I hike across the country coming up, I'll be working with Lions a lot. And they get involved in local humanitarian causes in a way that, you know, rolling up their sleeves and working with people. I mean, I'm not saying it's always that way, but, you know, it's a tendency that way. You get they're involved and connected with the people of their community rather than, say, you know, coming in and you know, providing, you know, assistance from on high, so to speak. And there's other clubs sort of like that. Kiwanis, Rotaries, and things like that. You can find that kind of civic involvement, connecting up with those kind of clubs. I would say churches are a good avenue in terms of, in particular, visiting shut-ins and all that kind of stuff. That kind of activity you'll find at churches. So if you're spiritually inclined, church is a good place where you might be rolling up your sleeves and getting together and helping your community a better place.
You know what?
And then I'm sorry.
Hold you up for a minute, because there's a thought I had as you're talking. One of the biggest challenges we have to this today is the way that the culture is based. We give billions of dollars in humanitarian aid. We're out there doing war. We're doing all those things. It's up in the trillions of dollars where people right here in this country are suffering, are without, don't have the right hospitalization, don't have enough to eat, don't have a job, and so on and so forth. You want to go to school, it's going to cost you an arm and a leg. You know, the 30-some-odd percent average dropout rate across country. So somewhere we're losing, I hope your word gets out, because somewhere we're losing that humanitarian, that human touch, that element that we have always had. Because if we try to help somebody and then we realize that if we try to help them, it's going to get blocked someplace and it's just going to go outside the borders, there's where the problem lies. And it's to regenerate it right here in this country, that's where it starts, that sense of humanity, that spark, and then it can expand out.
Yes, grassroots. I'm very much I call myself a grassroots empiricist, I guess, combining, you know, where I think things ought to start and, you know, going by experience. What's your experience? As opposed to, say, what's your fixed belief in something? What's your experience? What's going on in your community? And depending, you know, maybe you were believed in one ideology, but things change over time, and you ought to be willing to adjust depending on what's going on in your local community to help. You know, the proof is in the pudding. If you want to be a humanitarian, if you want to help those around you, there's lots of grand ideologies out there, but what you really need to focus on is the person standing next to you.
Obviously, I think if anybody had ever been in the service, 100 years ago I was in the Marine Corps, and the one thing that I learned going through training, etc., and thank God I never had to see any combat, I would have gone, but I just was at that time there wasn't. And the one thing that I learned as far as humanity goes, that person that's at your back, it doesn't matter what their color is, what their, you know, their race, their ethnicity, gender, whatever the case may be, they're protecting you. You are protecting them. That's a bond of humanity. It's just too bad that we have to think that the only way you're going to get that is if you're in a combat situation. It's too bad that we just can't have that. You cannot walk down any given street in a major city today without getting hurt or somebody trying to attack. There's where the problems lie. That needs to be cleaned up. Humanity has to start right there and then spread out. And that happens because we have gotten to a point in this country that a lot of the kids don't think that there's anything ahead of them. There's no value to going to school. There's no value to doing certain things. And the value for going out and getting trouble and high and whatever it is senior to that other value. So I think everything that you're saying is spot on. I think it should start right here in the inner cities and then work its way out and expand itself.
Yeah, you touched a nerve there in terms of one of the things you said. Bring up an example of what happened. You know, I'm calling from Connecticut, and not far away is Hartford. And there was big news a few years ago about a person who was a hit-and-run victim, and he was just left lying there in the streets. And that's not the only example. There's sociology textbook examples of similar kind of things, people screaming in the suburban neighborhood and no one coming to their rescue. And the point I want to get across is in a small band society, and I should put out right now, I'm not trying to advocate everyone get into loincloths and don spears and what have you, but you know, when we get together in an intimate setting with small groups of people, that kind of thing would never happen. Social responsibility innately is high when you're, you know, in the situation you mentioned for the Marines, for instance, you know, when you're in the right kind of situation, a band of brothers, if you will, social responsibility is high. It's when you're part of this large hierarchical, paternal, centralized structure, social structures, that you start losing responsibility. Responsibility gets replaced by commitment, if you will. You know, as long as you say the right things, you're cool, but you don't necessarily have to be responsible.
No, and when it really comes down to it, there was I forgot the name of the law, but there was a law at one time, and I do not know if it's in effect anymore, but if you saw somebody laying down in the street, and this used to be in Los Angeles where I grew up, that you had to stop and help them. But it got to a point, if you stopped and helped them, you'd get sued or arrested. So the people got scared. When they got scared, they stopped their humanity. And I think that in and of itself is the biggest problem. If I help somebody, are they going to accept the help, or am I going to get in trouble for doing so?
Yeah, that's crazy, isn't it? But that's sort of how things evolved when, you know, you lose sight of belonging to others and you're belonging to other things that become more important than the neighbors around you.
And interesting, let me bring up a point, because when we talk about belonging, everything you're saying is so spot on. What we do is we move towards where we're going to be acknowledged and we have identity. That used to be the family. If you're not getting it in the family, you're going to go out someplace else that acknowledges you and you have an identity with them if you have to go out and kill somebody to prove you're part of the gang. So the point of contention is everything you're saying is spot on. They're misdirecting it. And I really believe the name of your book in and of itself says it, Systems Out of Balance.
Yeah, the subtitle of that book is How Misinformation Hurts the Middle Class. So if I come out with a new edition, I think I'm going to change that to How Misinformation Hurts Us All. But the idea, once again, is that one of the biggest ways we're misinformed is about ourselves. That we think that what's going on with large, anonymous, paternal, hierarchical social structures is the norm, when it's not really the norm. The norm is what happens in your family. The norm is what happens when you get together, bond together with a community. Like, you know, I'm fortunate. I live in a small rural town, and there is a very strong sense of community around here. You know, Norfolk, Connecticut, town of 1,600. We're the same size we were in the year 1,800. So sure, we've stayed a rural community forever. And there is a very high degree of social responsibility in this kind of setting. And there still is in settings all across the United States. But as we become more urbanized, and that's not to say, actually, I'd like to say, for an example, Norris Square in Philadelphia is an urban neighborhood that really has got it together. I won't go into the details, but you can be in an urban neighborhood and still one for all for one, the Marine sort of thing, band of brothers, small group of people, intimate responsibility. It can happen in an urban neighborhood, but unfortunately, too often it doesn't. There's just this anonymous, it lost in the sauce occurrence that happens in urban neighborhoods and even suburban neighborhoods. In fact, suburban neighborhoods may be worse than the urban neighborhoods.
Kirk, a major question that should be asked, this is the big one that's got to be asked. When you talk about misinformation, what I've seen so far, misinformation comes from somebody wanting you to vote for them, or they want you to do something, so they give you what they think you need to hear, so you'll follow along with it. And I think the first question that should ever be asked when you're about ready to partake in something, participate, is what's driving it? What's behind this thing? What is it that we are really looking at? Then, if we ask the right questions, we get the right answers for the right questions, and we move forward with it. If we don't know, we usually ask the wrong questions, get the right answers for the wrong questions, and we are just exactly where we are today.
Well, I would say that's a good philosophy, Michael. I would say that's a good strategy to use. There's, you know, my input to it, my contribution, I guess, is as sure. that of a scientist. I mean, I'm not an economist or a political scientist or even a cultural anthropologist, so I've done a bit of research in that area. What I bring to the table in writing that book while speaking about all those social systems is that I'm a scientist, and I know the difference between good and bad data, and I've used that as what's the difference between good and bad or information and misinformation. And
sure.
one thing to keep in mind is, here's one thing to keep in mind. Information, true information, whether it's good or bad, travels. The
yeah.
Model T, for instance, didn't need advertising because it was such a good deal. It was such a good idea that it traveled, the news of it traveled on its own accord. In order to overcome information with misinformation, you have to outspend it.
Yeah.
So that's
and to know that there is a dynamic that occurs when you hear the information. We'll go right back to survival. You were talking primitive. You go right back to survival. We do what it takes to protect us. Based on the information that comes in, you're going to have a chemical change to go on through your body. And that's going to dictate the behavior. It's going to touch an emotion. The emotion will dictate a behavior, and the behavior is how you deal with everything in your life. So based on the information that comes in, it's either going to scare you into it, or it's going to cause you to want to move forward because you like what you hear. But whatever it is, there's a chemistry change that goes on.
Yeah, good point. Good point, Michael. And on the other end of this, I talk about in that book how the nerves that are hit upon, I don't talk about it from a neurobiology point of view, but
yeah.
that either vanity or apprehension is played upon to misinform us, or cynicism. Those three things
sure.
I talk about all throughout the book, that if someone's appealing to your fear, your apprehensions, or your vanity, or your cynicism, it's time to watch out.
Yeah, and we can sum it up, and we're running out of time now, Kirk, but we can sum it up in vote for me. That's what it comes down to. Appeal to, they know how to do it. Let me ask you this. Do you have a website we can find you at, and where do we buy the book?
The website, The Hiking Humanitarian, because I'm about to walk across country to put out that message to believe in humanity. So that's www.hikinghumanitarian.com. The book, Systems Out of Balance, it's available at Amazon. All you have to do is go to Amazon and type in Systems Out of Balance in the search engine. You'll find it quick enough. The Five Forgotten Truths won't come out until after I'm done hiking across the country with my Believe in Humanity message. But if you go to the website, there'll be an opportunity to get the newsletter and get a discounted copy of the book for when it comes out after the journey.
Wonderful. Hey, thank you so much for being with us. And let us know when you get back from, that's a long hike. Let us know when you get back. We'll have you come back on.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Take care. Good night.
Good night. Bye.
Pleasant as home is, it isn't what road is, so why stay there when there are so many fabulous faraway places to see? Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark.
Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris, and Venice. Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
Janice Hoskin with us. She's the mother of three sons, including Matthew. She's a teacher. She's written children's books under the name of Janice Credit Poltulny. And she's the author of For the Love of Matthew and is currently working on a sequel detailing her son's life after age 17. And let us say, Janice, I welcome to the show.
Thank you.
By the way, did I pronounce your name correctly, Hoska?
It's Hoska.
Hoska. Okay.
Now it's
I will never mispronounce it again. Okay.
That's okay.
Let me do this to lay a base of what we're going to talk about, because it's very critical and it's going to touch a lot of lives out there and people who get involved and find out and have no idea where to go or in big trouble. It's a mother bears her soul as she tells of finding out her son has Down syndrome and the grief, the pain, the guilt that follow. Her story is interwoven with other families' tragedies as she is determined to devote her life to teaching him, making sure that everything possible is done to ensure his growth and his learning. And when you first found out that Matthew had Down syndrome, I'm not going to ask you how you felt. My goodness, that obviously we're aware of that. But what was the response that you had? And also, what is Down syndrome? Did you know exactly what you were dealing with?
Well, at the time, I had studied about Down syndrome in college. And, you know, so from textbooks, that's the only thing I had was information from textbooks. And it wasn't real encouraging. I wasn't sure, really, you know, the nitty-gritty. I asked my doctor, how bad is it going to be? And, of course, he said, we have no idea. But he gave me a lot of negatives, like it's possible he'll never be able to take care of himself. He'll never be able to have a job or... And so it was very discouraging. And what made it worse is that they moved Matthew to another hospital because they needed to test him for Down syndrome, because they said at the time they weren't positive. And the separation between the two of us was very, very difficult. I spent days just in a very bad way, you know, trying to deal with the news and then the separation. So it wasn't really good.
The other side of this is I'm looking at this, and by the way, I have the book in front of me. The other side of this is a look at it. It's the not just dealing with Matthew, working with him, but you've got two other sons, and right. how do you balance the attention between the three with what you had to deal with Matthew? That had to be tough, and it had to have an effect on them.
Oh, yes. It wasn't easy. In the first place, they had lost their dad about a couple years before that. So they were not only dealing with a new brother, but they were also dealing with a new stepdad. They were dealing with living in a new town, and it was some very difficult times. I was always trying to kind of be in the middle and taking care of all the kids and my husband, and it was difficult.
Oh, sure.
So, yeah, there were some very trying years. But no, we made it through.
Let me ask you, what exactly is Down syndrome?
It's a condition where there's an extra chromosome, and the doctors have no idea why it happens. It happens about once in every 700 births, and it's not always. It has different degrees. You know,
no, well, let me hold you up just for a second. Let's take this and break it down. Now, a chromosome is a what? What's the responsibility of that?
It's kind of an indicator of all our traits. It's kind of like the DNA where you, the chromosomes determine your hair color, your eye color, so forth. And with Down syndrome, there's an extra chromosome. And it happens at conception.
Now, practically, how would this cause Matthew to be different?
Well, it causes a delay in mental capabilities. There's some physical problems that sometimes arise. In many Down syndrome, babies with Down syndrome, they have heart problems. And that was ruled out real early for Matthew, which we're very grateful about. It affects things like their ears, their sight. It can have other medical problems that normally wouldn't come up in a child. But everyone is different too.
This is a prime example of the and I love doctors. They're great. There's no question about it. But the doctor today is not the be all end all. I mean, there are other opinions out there, and the key here is what they said to you. He might he might not be able to take care of himself, and so on and so forth. Now, how old is he now?
He's 25.
Okay, he's 25. But by 10, he's playing the piano. He read at 3 years old. This was all about saying, well, that's what you think, and that's not what's going to happen here. And I really believe that strength and conviction can cause things to turn for people if you've got the strength to know that you're not going to let it happen.
Right. Yes, exactly.
Now, how'd you deal with that? Go ahead.
Pardon me? No, I felt that right away. And the first thing I said was, I will just devote my life to him. I will just do everything I can to ensure that he will learn. And being an elementary school teacher, I just used whatever experience and knowledge that I had in teaching. And I started from day one. And he picked up on things. It was amazing. You know, a lot of times people hear their child has a disability that they're not able to learn, and so they go along with that, and they don't bother to try. And it's such a big mistake because there's so many things that they can do.
And, Janice, this is what I would have heard in that. What I would have heard is they have a learning disability. They don't learn like other kids learn. So
then they
learn a different way. And
right.
You go after a different way, yeah.
Yes, exactly. That's very true. And every child is different. You know, you have to kind of figure out what type of learner they are. Now, with Matthew, he was a visual and an auditory learner. If he sees something, he hears something, that's how he learns the best. So I just, and I think that's where his music came from, too. You know, he heard music and he wanted to play it.
Yeah. Okay, so you caught that, you saw it, and then you built on it. Now he's 25 years old. Does he have the ability to live on his own?
He does. He's still living at home, but he could definitely live on his own. He's very independent. He does everything for himself. We don't really have to do much of anything for him. He holds down two jobs, and besides he works at a motel, and then he works at Pizza Hut. And then he also has jobs playing his music.
Okay, so in essence, it's turned into I'm going to call it a normal life for him.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Is there anything that's lacking at all?
Yes, his speech. He has a very hard time with his speech.
Okay.
And we're still working on that. You know, when he talks very softly and not always not all the time. And I can understand whatever he says, but I'm always worried that he's not going to be able to convey what he's thinking and needing to other people.
Of course, then when he's working...
that's a major problem.
But when he's working, he's not, you know, mom's not there and he's not at home, so he must be able to convey.
Yes, and he can to some degree, but like I said, it's just not, he doesn't communicate like you and I would, but he has his own way, and like I said, he says things in very few words, but we're just trying to get him to expand upon that as much as possible.
Now, by the way, he's 25, but is he 25, or are you still dealing with maybe an 8 or 9-year-old? Now, that's a question. I have no idea.
Uh-huh. Not really. I would say that I'm not sure what to say as far as how old, not chronologically, but how mentally he is. Would say more like maybe a 14-year-old.
Okay.
As far as, I think there's one thing about children with Down syndrome is they remain innocent. They remain childlike in many ways. As far as capabilities, he's capable of just about anything. But he's very childlike in a lot of ways.
Now, it's going to be very interesting because when, you know, the goal is to get him independent. I'm sure that's that. But it's going to be very hard to let him be independent with that's you sitting there.
Right.
Yeah, that's a lot of the effort and everything, you know, you put so many years into. That's going to be kind of tough if he does get independent and lives on his own.
Uh-huh. Yes. Well, it's something we're working on. About a year ago, he tried it. And he was going to move into a house with some other young men and spent one night there and decided he wanted to be at home. And right now the opportunity is coming up again. And so, and this is a new apartment building, and so we're going to try and see how he can deal with that. It's important that he is independent. It's very important.
Oh, sure. Let me ask you this. Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he needs to know that... he can rely on us, you know, to help him, if he needs help. But he does need that independence. If something ever happened to us, you know, he needs to have that going for him before that happens.
Okay, I picked this book up and I read it for the love of Matthew. I read it page by page, cover to cover. Janice, what's my takeaway? What do I, Michael Ray, the reader, get out of this? What's the one overarching theme that you want to make sure gets across to the reader?
I want people to know. Let's go back just a little bit. As I told you, when I first found out he had Down syndrome, I looked everywhere for something that would be encouraging, something that would tell me what I could do. And I didn't find anything. And so when I was going through his growing up years, I kept journals and I chronicled everything I did with him. And as he was growing and as he was learning and picking up things and methods were working, that's when I decided to write the book so that other parents could be encouraged, could read a story with a happy ending, with positive results. And hopefully they can use some of the techniques that I used. And I actually correspond with a lot of mothers who have bought the book and they write to me and they ask me questions or they tell me about what's going on in with their child, and I welcome that. I love to hear from people. I answer all my correspondence personally. So that's my goal, is to help people deal with going through the same thing that I went through so many years ago.
Okay. Now the key is you have to have been there and done that to be able to truly create a path for people to walk down. The Down syndrome, is that something that's prevalent? Do we find a lot of kids with that today?
Oh, yes. Well, as I said before, it happens about once in 700 births. So it's amazing how often it does happen.
So is that any more or any less than it was 10, 15, 20, 25 years ago? Have we seen a spike, or is it pretty constant? That's what it is.
You know, that's really hard to determine because years ago, when people had a child with Down syndrome, they would put them in an institution and you wouldn't hear about it. And these days, you know, luckily people are keeping their children at home. They're working with them. They're teaching them. And you see them in the community more and you hear about it more. But I think even 25 years ago when Matthew was born, you really didn't hear too much about it. A lot of mothers chose to have abortions when they found out their child had Down syndrome. So I don't think it's a matter of it happening more often. I think it's just that you hear about it more because they're not institutionalizing them, and they're not aborting them. So we have more children.
Janice, we're starting to run out of time. Is there a website we can find you at?
You can find me at www.JaniceHuska.com, and there's also a link to my son's website, which is www.MattHuska.com. And he has a couple of CDs that he has available there, and also my book is on the website.
Wonderful. Hey, Janice, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Well, thank you very much. I enjoyed it.
Take care. Good night.
Good night now.
I can only give you love that lasts forever, and the promise to be near each time you call, and the only heart I own for you and you alone. That's all, that's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall, and a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. That's all, that's all.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You are listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark.
If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore.
Dr. Larry Shigoris with us. He is the author of The Secret of Getting a Job After College, Marketing Tactics to Turn Degrees into Dollars. His opinions on modern marketing practice have appeared in hundreds of media outlets throughout the world, including the Today Show, Fox News, CNN, Wall Street Journal. He's an expert on social media, branding, and effective use of a variety of marketing strategies. And let us say, Larry, hi, welcome to the show.
It's good to be on the show. Thank you very much.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, when it really comes down to it, kids go to school. And then they graduate, and then they really learn what the world is about after they get out of school, but it doesn't tell them how to go out and market themselves for a job. So let me take you all the way back to the very beginning with this. What was it that caused you to put this to pen, to look at this subject matter and realize there could be a problem out there for some of these kids?
Well, I won't take you through every blow by blow, but it goes back to the time when I was a student. Many years ago, I was a student, and I had a professor that gave a lecture that stayed with me for more than 20 years. He talked about resumes that get interviews and interviews that get jobs. And it resonated with me, and I was working in industry as a senior advertising executive. And when I became a professor a few years ago, students would come up to me and ask me, "Professor, how do you get a job after you graduate? Can you give me some hints? Can you give me some tips?" And I would, every semester in all my classes, give one lecture that was above and beyond what I would normally do for the material I was covering, a lecture on how to get a job. And that lecture kept getting longer and longer as I learned more about the students and what they needed. And finally someone said, "You know, you ought to put this in a book." I said, "You know what, if I do put it in a book, it'll make it a lot easier because then I can just give the book to my students." So that pretty much was the origin or the motivation to write the book.
You know, one of the keys in getting a job, you've got to be a little bit different than the guy that's applying for the job alongside of you. And when people hear the word branding, Larry, branding, the first thing out of the you would think of is Coca-Cola, Pepsi, et cetera. You know, major brands, major products. but you really have to brand yourself as an individual, don't you?
Well, that's right, because just as you point out, just as products such as Coca-Cola, Pepsi, McDonald's, they have a certain image in your mind when I mention their names to you. When people present themselves to others, particularly when it comes to, for a job opportunity, whether it's sharing their resume or a cover letter or a telephone interview or walking into a conference room or an office to be interviewed, they are, in effect, telegraphing or conveying their brand and what they represent. So we need to be conscious as people looking for jobs, what is our brand? What do we stand for? How do we want people to remember us after we've left the interview? What do we want people to say about us? And we need to be focused along those lines so that we're singularly focused and people have a good sense of what we would like to be thought of. That's correct.
Sure. It's not who I am. It's what I can do for you is really the key there. You know, people go in and I'm a this and I'm a that, and that's all well and good. But what are you going to do for that person? And the word marketing and sales come up. There's so many people frightened to death of the word selling. And when you're doing what you're doing, you are selling what you can do for that company, no matter, I don't care how you look at it. And if you want to change the word for offer, to offer, but you're going to get the absolute best you can out of an interview if somebody's going to hire you. So in essence, it's a process to market yourself in such a way that they see what they want can come out of what you can offer.
Well, that's correct. I mean, many people get a little frightened or a little turned off by the notion that they have to sell themselves, but you have to sell yourself. In my book, what I discuss in my book is I talk about the competition for jobs, just how many people are graduating. You know, every year 3 million people in the United States receive some kind of a degree or diploma. And in addition to those 3 million, there are people all over the world getting degrees and wanting to come here. Now, you're not competing with all of those people for a job, but you're competing with a lot of them. And sure. And so you've got to look upon it as I have to be looked upon differently than the other person. And first thing you got to do is figure out what do you stand for. The second thing you got to figure out is, okay, if I stand for this, this is how I want people to think of me. I want them to think of me as the serious analyst or the motivational speaker or the great writer, whatever it might be. Then you have to think about how do I create my resume and other marketing package elements so people see me that way and then prepare myself for an interview in which basically an interview is a sales presentation. You're selling yourself in that interview to somebody, and you got to be successful. I don't care if you're getting a job if you're applying for a job as a teacher or a cook or a dishwasher, you're selling yourself to somebody, and you have to close the sale. So it's really a process. There are steps to it. But they're not complicated. They're easily learned if you pay attention, if you read my book. But if you pay attention, if you approach it as a marketing opportunity and a marketing challenge.
And that's realistically what it is. Even if you're not a salesperson, it does not matter. In this particular instance, you've got to be able to sell your ability to handle what it is that they want. And I think one of the things also, that most people don't do, is to find out what that company wants ahead of time. Go talk to people who work for the company. Find out what their, what that culture of the company is like, so you know what they want going in, and then you can match what you have to what they want, and now you've got a sale.
Oh, that's a wonderful point. That's a wonderful point. What I call it is you have to do just as companies go about preparing, doing their market research, you have to do your market research. Actually, in the book, I lay out all the easy steps to do market research. Companies are impressed when you approach them. Employers are impressed when you talk to them, and you convey a sense that you did your homework. You learned something about them. They're not turned off by it. They don't feel as if you've stalked them or you've spied on them. They say to themselves, this person cared enough to learn about me or about my company or about my industry. And if you do learn those things, you'll come in with a little bit different perspective, you'll be more spontaneous, you'll be more confident, and the confidence begets more effective performance in an interview, and before you know it, they're begging you to join the company. And that's pretty much how it works. You've got to do your market research in advance. Absolutely, you're correct.
No question. This is what I love about, you know, guys like you and doing what you're doing. There's so many people out there that don't know how to do it. This is not a course that you can take in high school or college. This is getting out there and actually getting it done. This goes beyond academia to practical application. And most people, it's not what they don't know. It's what they don't know that they don't know, which causes them not to get the job.
Oh, perfectly stated. You know, students say to me, Professor, I have an opportunity for an interview. I'm not so sure I'm really interested in the job. And I would say, you know what? You may not be interested in it right now, but if you went on the interview, you might find that you are. And by the way, if it turns out you're not, just think how much of a better interviewee you're going to be by getting this practice, by going out there and practicing what I've taught you in the classroom. Go out there and take that interview. And go through the steps. You may, even if you don't like the job, you may now be a much better interviewee and a much more likely successful person in the next opportunity. You have to practice these things. You have to read, study, but then you have to go out there and give it a try and not be afraid of it. It's not that hard if you practice it.
Now, by the way, when you walk in with these skills, things could happen for you that you had no idea that could happen. Just very quickly, I'm going to go back to when I was 19, 20 years old, and I worked for Norris Thermidor Corporation in the City of Industry in the Los Angeles area. And I spent, now I'm 19 years old, right? I'm a kid, and I spent 8 hours a day I had the mid shift from 5 o'clock to like 11, 12 o'clock at night, my social life down the tubes, right? But I, you know,
sorry
I,
about that.
Yeah, and I stood there 8 hours a day. These wheels would come up on a pallet, and I'd take the wheel off, and I'd stick it up on this conveyor belt, and that's what I did. So I decided I want to get out there. I want to do something else. So I got into the employment part of it, and the man that was sitting there, I said, I want to get on days, and he fell off his chair laughing, you know, union, seniority, et cetera. I'd been there about a month or two. And so I started to walk out. And I put my hand on the door, and I walked back, and I said, you know, I got a half a brain here, and if you let me use it for the company, I can benefit you. And he stopped, and he looked at me, and he said, what do you know about chemistry? I said, what do I have to know? He said, well, we'll talk to you tomorrow. So he set me up with the chemical engineer, asked me a few simple basic questions, which I didn't know the answer to, but the way he asked them, I gave him the right answer, and I became a chemical lab tech. Because you don't know what else is there until you open yourself up for it. So the job that you apply for may not be there, but they may have something 10 times better.
Well, that's right. You did something in that example as a 19-year-old that demonstrated tremendous maturity for a 19-year-old. Because what you did is you recognized, and you said it as much, I can benefit you. I can help you. That's what companies want to hear. When I describe how to write a cover letter, some people write these cover letters and they say, I'm interested in your company because it's in a high growth industry or you're growing very quickly. I'd really like to have an opportunity to go to work for you. Well, you know what? You're wasting somebody's time saying things like that. They know you want to work there. They understand that they're in a high-growth industry. They don't have to be told that. What they want to hear is what you told that person when you were 19 years old. I can help you. I can benefit you. I can do these things for you that will make you more effective. And, of course, if you do your market research in advance, you'll learn what the companies are looking for and what they want to hear, what the organizations want to hear. And, by the way, it's not just about companies. It's about medical offices, hospitals, school systems, governmental organizations. In other words, every organization comes down to people, and individual people, like bosses and supervisors and managers, they have jobs where they're under pressure to produce, and they want people working for them that will produce, that will contribute, that will make it easier for them to be more effective. And what you did as a 19-year-old is exactly what all 19-year-olds and all 21- and 22-year-olds who are graduating need to do. Here's what I can do for you. That's perfect. That's absolutely perfect.
Let's take a wild guess here. Let's have some fun. And what do you think what do you think my hourly jumped up to when I did this? What do you think I was paid an hour?
Well, what were you paid paid after you made the jump?
Yeah, after I made the jump.
I bet you probably got a 35% increase in pay.
Yeah, but I mean, take a wild guess of what the hourly rate was.
Back when you were 19?
Yeah.
Oh, why? Of course, I don't know how old you are. From your picture, you look like a very young man. But I would say you're probably $8, $9.
You ready for this? I hope you're sitting down. $1.65 an hour.
All right, $1.65 an hour. All right.
Yeah, no, we're going back to 1961, too.
All right, okay, okay. Yeah. Well, you're making a lot more than that now, I'll bet. And it's because you've been selling yourself. You know what you're doing. That's why you have a platform. That's why you have an audience.
It's gone up to $2.50 an hour, so I'm rocking here. But the point of contention is it was a sign of the times, and it was just spontaneous. And the key is if you know that, I had no idea why I did that at the time. But if I had known the dynamic of what would occur if I would have done that, how many people, and you're saying it, if you know what you're doing going in, you're going to get a whole lot more out of it.
Well, you get a whole lot more out of it because, first of all, right away, you're going to be viewed differently by the people who are looking at you because you're coming across as someone who knows more, and that's what they want. And by the way, if you know more about what you want and what the situation is, you're doing your preparation, you're doing a little research on the company or the organization, you're going to make a contribution that it's just not, being arrogant or saying, I can help you, I can benefit you. The fact is, you can help them. You will benefit them. I'm sure you benefited them when you said what you said back many years ago, and that's why you got the promotion and probably got some additional raises. You got to do your homework. You have to be intellectually curious. You shouldn't be shy about putting in a little extra work on your own time to learn about the employer. Even after you get on the job, you're still selling yourself to the employer. You're still selling yourself to people around you because now you're looking for the next promotion. Or someone's going to leave the organization, go somewhere else, and hopefully they'll take you with them. That's the way the world works.
Sure. And by the way, if you don't believe in yourself, they're not going to believe in you.
Oh, so true. You have to have that kind of confidence, and it comes across. People know when someone isn't confident. I tell my students, when you do your homework, when you do the market research you need to do as part of your marketing plan, you'll get more confident. You'll get a little bit more swagger in your step. You'll be a little bit more assured of yourself. You go into the interview, you'll have a tighter handshake, a stronger handshake. You'll have more eye contact. Everything about you will just telegraph, this person is a confident person. This person is one of the generals or colonels I want in my army, so to speak. It comes across that way, but it starts with doing your homework. What I say in my book is first understand who you are. What is it that you want? Start with the things you want to do with your life and with your future. And then look around, try to find the opportunities that match up with those things that are about you. And there's some steps in my book. I provide some tips on how to do that. And then after knowing what are the best opportunities for you, then you put your marketing plan to work to identify the companies in the area or the organizations that best match up for those opportunities. You send your resumes to those places with the right cover letter that reflects who you are. You prepare for the interview. You do some follow-up things when you get the interview to help close the sale. Before you know it, you're starting your career and you're moving forward and you're moving upward. And you, probably for a happier life because you'll be doing things that you want to do. People, when they do things they want to do, always are a lot happier, a lot more contented at work and at home.
And by the way, in the job, I would say the job application saturated world, there is something that I didn't have years ago. Larry, you've got social networking today. You've got Facebook, Twitter, man.
Yes, you do. In fact, we just did some research on Facebook, and we found that in terms of like things like Twitter and Facebook, the biggest problem is that most people don't know how to use these techniques. They don't realize that some of these areas such as and methods such as LinkedIn are better for a professional presence. Others such as Facebook are oftentimes better for a more of a personal side of yourself. But regardless, you have to assume in this day and age of privacy issues and information leaking out by accident that anything that's out there on Twitter, Facebook, or LinkedIn and the other sites could become public knowledge. So you have to approach whatever you put on the internet, every stroke of the keypad, you got to think about someone may see this someday. Someone that I don't even know and expect to see it will see it someday, and I'd better make sure that this photo or this update is the kind of thing I want people to see and not something that might embarrass me. Now, when it comes to students, students sometimes get, you know, they get embarrassed by some of the photos they put up, or the organizations that they join, or the events they tell others to go to. So Facebook, you know, one of our statistics in our research is we found that 75% of college students have something terribly wrong with regard from the eyes of an employer on their Facebook profile. So it's time, when you start looking for a job, that's not the time to clean it up. The time is to keep it clean from the moment you start, you know, using Facebook or LinkedIn or Twitter. You have to approach it as it tells the world what your brand is. It tells the world what you're all about. So you have to manage your presence very professionally. Absolutely.
And by the way, that HR person, the one that's in charge of hiring, if they're smart, they will use these resources to find you. And then, you know, the old days of 6 degrees of separation where you knew somebody who knew somebody who knew somebody, maybe if you knew 15 or 20 people, it was a lot. Larry, you do this right, and I know you cover this, but if you do this right, you can be reaching hundreds of millions of people, and somebody is going to see you.
You could be reaching people in other parts of the world.
Yeah.
You could be certainly reaching people in other parts of the country. So it's like a billboard for yourself, and if you do it right, good things will happen, and surprise contacts will emerge that you never anticipated yet. I'll tell you something else interesting. People who are your friends who didn't know this side of you may say to themselves, oh, I didn't know he was interested in that, or he can do that, or he did this. And they will begin to help steer you in better directions. It's amazing how some of our friends don't necessarily know all the things professionally we seek to do with our lives. And the beauty of these social networking sites is they allow us to let our friends in a little bit more into our lives in a way that gets our friends an opportunity to see us in a way that we hadn't thought about before. So better connections are made. In life, it's not just what you know, it's who you know, and quite frankly, who you know matters a lot more than what you know. And,
oh, absolutely,
and you can learn a lot of things. You can read books, you can teach yourself many things, but it's hard to meet a lot of people. But in this day and age of technology, you can meet a lot of people pretty quickly. So you can enlarge your network very quickly, and that's what you have to work at, and that's very important. And you're right. The social networking part of it is very, very important.
Yeah, no question about it. And it's called knowing how to use it. And I've said this time and again in different phases and fields that we take a look at. It's not something that you're taught. It's something that goes on above and beyond normal education. Academia does not teach marketing and selling yourself.
It doesn't. And in fact, the other thing that we're oftentimes, some of us are taught and some of us aren't taught, is the whole notion of networking. We talk about networking now, and right away we think of LinkedIn and Facebook, but the old-fashioned networking still remains the most powerful tool. And by the old-fashioned networking, I mean going to a club meeting, going to a church meeting or a synagogue meeting, going to an alumni event, going to a professional society event, going to a volunteer organization, showing up professionally, meeting people, shaking their hands. If you're a student, as I say in my book, if you're a student, you should have a business card, because just because you're a student doesn't mean you shouldn't have a business card. Put your various, your LinkedIn address or your Facebook, put things on it if you think it's appropriate, but have a business card and give it to people when you meet them in a professional or semi-professional setting. You never know when that card will turn up in their wallet and they'll contact you. Have a story. I talk about the elevator speech. I'm sure you're familiar with that. What are you going to say to somebody if you're introduced by somebody else to them? What are you going to say? Just your name? Is that you're going to leave it at that? Or are you going to say a little bit more about yourself? And if you have an opportunity, the most deadly question in an interview is when a prospective employer says to someone, well, tell me about yourself. Well, you better have an answer to that question. When they say to you, tell me about yourself, what are you going to say? Have you thought it through? You need to do it, and that needs to be more than just a 10 or 15 or 20 second, a series of words. You need to think about what are you going to say for the next 2 or 3 minutes that tells them about you in a way that you want them to know you, that will help you solidify what your brand is in their mind. So networking, the single most important thing is networking. It's actually more important than the resume. My students like to focus a lot on resumes. Help me with my resume, professor. Help me with my resume. And I do, but far more important than that piece of paper, that resume.
Absolutely.
Your network.
Yeah, there's no question about that. And marketing is extremely important. And we touched on selling with that word that they don't like, but that's a word. If you define it, we're starting to run out of time now, but if you define selling, it is nothing more than offer and acceptance. And if you are married,
right,
and you said, you asked your fiance, or you asked your girlfriend at the time, will you marry me? You set up an offer. She could do one of two things, accept or reject. If she accepted, you sold her. That's the end of it.
There you go.
You go. Larry, website we can find you at.
The secret to getting a job after college is the website where all the information about me and the book and everything else can be found. There's some other links there that go to my own website, but I would start there, The Secret to Getting a Job After College. And there's like tips on the website as well, and other information, so people can understand just how best to think about the entire topic.
And by the way, Larry, thank you so much for joining us. And that thing about the $1.65 an hour—that's our secret.
You okay. Found the secret, Michael. Good to talk to you. Thank you very much.
Thanks. Good night.
Now that's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you'll adore for now and evermore. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. They would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you'll adore. Yeah, it's me that you'll adore. For now and evermore. That's all.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. And if there's someone you would like to see here interviewed on the show, go to the website, www.dresserafterdark.com. Get a hold of Radio Susie, and we'll get you on the air. Our guest, Brendan Burchard, with us, is the founder of Experts Academy and the number one New York Times and number one USA Today best-selling author of The Millionaire Messenger. He's also author of Life's Golden Ticket and one of the top business and motivational trainers in the world, an influential multimillionaire expert himself. He inspires over 2 million people a year with his books, newsletters, products, and appearances. And let us say, Brendan, hi, welcome to the show.
Hey, Michael. Thanks for having me. Nice to hear your voice.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. Brendan, let me ask you this. Is being a millionaire a mindset? Do you have to have that in your head before it can happen to you?
Yeah, I think that's a fair statement to have. You know, I like to tell people, you know, especially when they're starting out building a business and hoping to become millionaires, I love to say this phrase to them. I say, never let your small business make you small-minded.
Yeah.
You know, it's awfully hard when you first start out, as you know, you're only making a couple bucks here, a couple bucks there, or, sure, you know, a couple clients here, or tens of hundreds of clients here, but you need a couple thousand to hit that $1 million mark. And it's frustrating and hard on the way out. But if your mindset isn't already set that that's a possibility, then you've created your own barrier.
You know, I think the window of opportunity for your book is right here and right now. And one of the reasons for that is this. When the big corporations took over the mom and pops and they got into a multinational, a global competition, they had to go the same route as the mom and pops. They couldn't afford to compete, so they had to outsource business. When they outsourced, people went out on their own to become entrepreneurs. You know, they got behind their computer and they started to make money. But the key is there's so many people out there with the ability to do so, but the problem is they don't know how to do it. Brendan, that's why the Expert Academy should be absolutely expanding right now because of this need to know how to do it. They're out there. They got the ideas. They've got the enthusiasm. They're all dressed up. Nowhere to go.
I agree. I think the time has changed so significantly that we're about to witness a massive shift of that. You know, the old model used to be you have knowledge, you have expertise, you have talent, and so what you do is you go change and exchange that for a job with a major company. And in exchange, that major company takes your ideas, your knowledge, your expertise, and ultimately they translate that in some form or another to value, usually through products and programs and services, to the customer. In the industrial age, that was called the middleman.
Yeah.
So one of my big beliefs right now about the way we're about witnessing is that, you know, in business school, we teach all our students, hey, never have a middleman. It doesn't make any sense. But then we tell them, go get a job with the middleman. And I think that corporations and major companies, not that they're ever going to go to the wayside, but I think more and more people are going to realize, why do I have to work through a middleman to contribute to society anymore when now we've got the internet and we've got the ability for each of us to take our knowledge and to package it in a way that serves other people with, whether it helps them improve their lives or grow their businesses, and we can get paid in the process.
Oh, and the key is the ability, and you used the P word here, to package it. Most people do not know how to do that. You know, you go back, I've been jumping on this for I don't know how many years now, but you go to school, and what do they teach in school? Do they teach you how to market yourself, how to package yourself, how to go out into the world and actually make something of yourself? It stops with the knowledge, but you've got to be able to apply that knowledge. And thank goodness there's, you know, guys like yourself out there that will teach people to do so.
Yeah, thanks. Well, you know, in The Millionaire Messenger, we have this thing called the four P's. What are real experts, people who are taking their advice and knowledge and deciding to help other people with it and, you know, getting paid in the process, what do they do? And essentially they're doing four things all the time. They're doing positioning. They're positioning themselves as experts and leaders in their field by doing lots of research, understanding what's going on, having a perspective of the marketplace. They're positioning themselves by showing, you know, their what I call their expert story positioning. They're building them, their credibility base based on what they've been through and what they know. Then they are packaging. Yeah, they're taking that knowledge and they're packaging that knowledge, in, especially in my industry. And what we talk about in The Millionaire Messenger is really about what we call the expert industry. Anyone who's sharing their advice or how-to information with other people and doing it to make a difference that also make their income, you know, they're packaging it into books, CDs, audio programs, DVDs, online videos, you know, teleseminars, webinars. They're putting their information out there through workshops, live events, coaching programs, consulting programs. That's how they package their information. And then, of course, the third P is promoting. Like you just said, we're not teaching kids how to do marketing at all these days. It's hilarious. People think social media is the great savior, except I've got dozens of clients who have a million or more followers on Twitter and Facebook, and they're broke because they've never learned how to monetize. You know, if you don't know how to have a direct sale, as you guys were talking about earlier, then there's no way you're going to ever monetize even a large following. So you got to learn how to do intelligent and strategic promotions. And the last piece is you've got to learn how to partner. Partner with others to get the message out beyond yourself.
I think one of the most important things that we can realize today, and most people are frightened to death, and they're frightened to death, Brandon, for one reason and one reason only. They've been told that there's no money out there. That's not true. There's a tremendous amount of money out there, and there are people out there taking advantage. When I say taking advantage by using their professional expertise, their know-how, to be able to help people, etc. And there's a ton of money out there right now. You just have to know, you have to speak the language to be able to approach it and participate.
I can agree more. I don't think any other time in our history as a nation has so many people been looking for a second chance, been looking for a second stage of their career, been looking for something new. What they're really looking for is new information that can improve their life or grow their businesses. And if you have that information, you know, you have any advice or thoughts on how they can improve their lives at home or in their life, personally, professionally, or at their business in any way, then that advice can be monetized. You know, there's money in mentoring today because millions of people are looking for help. And if you have that and you put it up online, you can do great. You know, I have a 71-year-old client who makes $1 million a year teaching people how to do quilting right now. Quilting. Because people are wondering, you know, she's got all these people online who are looking for a solution. They go and say, well, how do you do this quilting? Tell me about a new pattern. What tool should I use? I've got other clients who have, you know, they just have some expertise in soft topics. I started out that way. I had a car accident, and I had some, you know, ideas about how people can improve their lives. I learned how to package that, promote it, and partner with others to get the message out, and in my first 24 months made $4.6 million.
Yep.
I mean, you and I know both, though, I could have stayed in corporate America and never made that.
That when, one of the things that we have to look at, you know, is, as far as giving advice, quote-unquote, quilting, et cetera, well, there's a rule that I've lived by for so many years now, and that rule is this. Brendan, that a good teacher knows when to be a student and a good leader knows when to follow. I change hats constantly. You always need that somebody who can look at what you're doing with a different set of eyes. Look over your shoulder, see what you're not seeing, and be able to work with that. And I think that in and of itself, that bring that invisible to the table, that is that unique selling proposition that most people don't even see that they have, and there's where the advice is. We get to see what we didn't see before, no matter what the subject matter is.
That's great. You know, what I always say is the only reason people pay an expert for anything, whether it's a doctor at a hospital or someone somewhere else, it's to solve a problem and offer perspective. Especially
sure.
The part about perspective. People want to talk to somebody who's been there, done that, or at least researched the game and the field enough to be able to say, you know what, based on everything you're telling me and what I know about out there happening, I'd say do A or B. And that perspective is invaluable because we, you know, we're in our own frame and we can't see what's really in the picture, you know, as they say. And so you've got to be able to have that perspective to offer us advice and how to and where to go.
Sure, and I think the only thing that that a person will buy today, and it boils down to something very simple, a solution to a problem, period, end. Whatever they're looking for, if you can provide the roadmap to get there, that's really where the key is, and I don't care if it's for a dollar and a half or 50 million. The idea is if there's some kind of a narrative, they hear some or see in their mind some kind of a narrative that allows them to see that what you're saying can fix the problem, that in and of itself, there's nothing more powerful.
That's right. And that's what's exciting about right now is, you know, people used to think they had to be rich and famous to make money online or to, you know, get attention. But these days you don't need that anymore because getting attention is so easy online. What you need is something of value to people. And I think that being that solution is important. I always say, stop trying to be a brand and be a solution. Because people don't buy brands anymore. People don't understand brands. What people do is they hop on Google and they look for the answer to a problem. Be the solution and your brand will build by itself.
No, absolutely. Let me play a game with you. Go with me on this just for a moment, okay? The Millionaire Messenger. Tell me what your book is about.
It's about how do you take your knowledge and your expertise and your information that you know about life and offer it to other people so it can improve their lives or grow their businesses, but make money at the same time. So as we've been talking about, how do you package your information in a intelligent way and put it out to the marketplace so you get your message out there in a bigger way, serve humanity, but also make money?
Okay, now I'm going to become Brendan, all right? Ask me what my book is about. Ask me what my book
What's
is
your
about.
Book?
You. That's really what it is. Your book is about me, isn't it?
It is about, I think, everyone who hears a message, when they read the title, they know automatically, you know. It's about being a messenger. It's about,
sure.
You want to get your message out there, make a difference, and make an income with it? Cool. Let me show you the new economy and how that works.
Yeah, but that you is not Brendan. That you is that person buying the book, going into the workshop, going to the seminar, because that's truly what it is. The Millionaire Messenger, make a difference in a fortune, sharing your advice. Well, you just talk to me. You just talk to every individual out there that sees this. And I really think that's the key to it. If you want to make $1 billion, you have to know what it's not what you're selling, it's what you're selling means, what your marketing means to that person on an individual level. It's the perceived value that we deal with. And most people don't get that.
I agree. And I think you said that the word there is value. You you know, the easiest way to build a brand in the, you know, expert advice or, you know, guru industry, whatever you call it, I just call it the expert industry, is by actually being the person who adds value. Being the person who, you know, puts out videos that aren't just sales, 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 but actually trains them on something, gives them high quality value that they can say, you know what, that piece of that tactical information that person just gave me, I can go use that right now and improve my life and my lot in life. I like this person. That's how you get real fans, followers, subscribers to your newsletters and your businesses, is you put real value out there. You put great information out there that helps them move from point A to point B, and they just say, this is so great. Then your sales are easy, because then you just say, hey, if you liked that, I have this stuff over here that goes a little deeper. Why don't you hit the add to cart button? And the game begins.
Yeah. But I think one of the keys are, too, the old ways of selling, they don't work anymore. It's gone. You know, find the hidden objection, do this, do that. It just doesn't work. The key today is people don't like to buy any or sell. They don't like to be sold to, but we love to buy. And if it's framed in such a way that we make the decision and we call ourselves to action, that's really where the key is in most of marketing today. You got Google. You can hit the button and find out anything you want about anything. You can find prices. You can just, it's unbelievable. It's mind-boggling. And the key there is, now that I can do all of these things, I've got to make the decision. And it's framed in such a way that I can see myself benefiting from what you have to say. You got me. And if we're saying the same thing in different words.
Absolutely. You know, I think the other keys are these days is that what people traditionally think of sales has really expanded in that, you know, you send them to a sales page and hopefully they'll buy from you. You know, that's an old model of the economy called ask and you shall receive.
Sure.
Geez, I got this thing for sale. Let me announce it to you. Now you can buy it. You know, and asking and shall receive, it just never worked. People hoped it would. That's why The Secret blew up big. But that's why so many people were disappointed with The Secret, because it's all about intention and just asking in the universe and hoping it lands on you. The reality, I think, that people are finding is that we're in a new economy in which give and you shall receive.
That's why Canfield had to redo it. That's why Canfield had to redo it. No, I remember exactly when it happened, sure. Yeah, they didn't tell people how to do it. They just said it would happen. Well, it didn't just happen. So they redid everything. They rewrote everything with all the workshops, the seminars, and the rest of it. And it's true. You've got to take some kind of action. You can't just sit there. It doesn't happen that way. Now, is there validity to The Secret? You bet there is. I've said this time and again to people. Are you miserable in your life? Yeah. Well, guess what you drew to you. So you have to choose what you want. You want a good, you want a bad, you get it. But you've got to have a roadmap to get there. And I think that's where most people get stuck.
Yeah, and you've got to do that old thing called work. You know, it's that the great old quote is most people miss opportunity because it looks like overall, it comes dressed in overalls and looks like work.
Yeah.
And so I think the challenge is to not only have the clarity and the intention to do great, but to have the initiative and the stick-with-itness that requires, you know, of all of us to really succeed in life, to keep going at it, you know, to not slow down just because we don't know something or don't have something, but rather if we don't know something or have something to succeed, then our job is to go learn it or go create it.
Rocky said it in the last movie, you know, life is tough and it'll grind you down. And it's not how hard you can hit that counts. It's how hard you can get hit, get up, and keep moving on. And to add something to that, learn a little bit more, get more of a dimension of yourself. And that's where success is. Brendan, we're just about out of time. I could talk to you all night, but we're close now. Now, do you have a website we can find you in the book at?
Sure. People can go to MillionaireMessenger.com and learn all about the book and also get some free training videos of how do you start your own expert career, how do you package yourself and get yourself out there in a bigger way. We provide tons of free training through that website and through Experts Academy website as well.
Wonderful. Brendan Burchard, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
My honor. Have a great evening. Thanks for helping me spread my own message.
Thank you. Good night.
Be well.
World can hurt us long as we're singing our song.
Give me trumpets, legato.
Put some saxes with them.
St- strings, pizzicato.
Add some rhythm.
I'm Michael Gray Dresser, and you are listening to Dresser After Dark. And if you're listening out there, tell your friends about the show. That's the way we grow, and that's what you truly call network. And that, my friends, is a wrap.
Long as we're singing, long as we're singing.